Don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
You want a podcast? Great. They have some audio on your website that nobody goes to.
You're listening to Vandaltron's Curious World Podcast. Sit back and relax. Everything's going to be cool.
Hello, 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 and welcome back to the Vandaltron Curious World Podcast special episode, a look at the year 1992. If you haven't already, I encourage you to go back and download part one, where we talk about worldviews. Part two, we're going to focus on, well, let's be honest, the fun stuff. We're going to talk about the world of entertainment, TV, music, the box office, and comic books. You know, 1992 was not just the year that a lot of music journalists point to as the death of hair metal and the birth of grunge. There was a lot of other things going on. And with me to dissect this, as in part one, is writer Jason Simons. So without further delay, the Vandaltron Curious World episode, special deep dive, 1992, part two, the world of entertainment starts right now.
I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
Are you crying?
No.
Are you crying? Are you crying? There's no crying. There's no crying in baseball.
Why don't you leave her alone, Jimmy?
Oh, you zip it, Doris.
All right, and we're back. This is part two of our discussion of 1992, which was a great year on many levels, but it was a pretty astonishing year in comic books. This was the year that a bunch of artists kind of broke off and made Image Comics. Todd McFarlane, Jim Lee, Rob Liefeld, Eric Larson, Mark Savistri. These were all kind of the top tier pencilers in the game, and they formed their own company, Image Comics. And it took off like wildfire. Everybody was like, oh shit. And then people like me started reading the titles. And they're like, what the fuck? Because these guys were, they were pencilers. They weren't necessarily writers. They weren't that good.
Yeah, I remember Youngblood number one, and I was actually looking forward to it. I don't know why, looking back in retrospect. I actually bought it the day it went on sale at Newbury Comics or whatever. And I remember reading it, and I was actually going to buy a couple copies, because in those days, comics were going up, like, they would jump in value because there was such a demand. But what people didn't realize at the time is they were printing so many copies that the value would just drop quick if there was an initial boost. So I was actually going to buy a couple copies, and I just decided to buy the one copy. Well, thankfully I did, because I still have it. And I actually looked at it recently, and it's just not very good.
Yeah, the big four were Youngblood, which was like, who are these guys?
Well, it was like a much lesser version of other titles.
Yeah, Wildcats.
He was doing X-Force. Liefeld was doing X-Force, at least on every chance of name. He was doing X-Force for Marvel, and then he left. So he basically created X-Force Light.
And Eric Larson was basically a poor man's Rob Liefeld.
Yeah, I didn't follow Eric Larson as much. I mean, I wasn't too familiar with his stuff. I know he did that title, Savage Dragon.
Yes.
For a long time, which I've never read an issue.
I've never, yeah. And Wildcats, what acronym, CATS? I don't know.
Yes, yes. I never read that one either. But I got some Spawns.
Exactly. Their big title was Todd McFarlane's Spawn, which... you know, I got a bunch of issues. I got the toys, but after a while, I was just like, I don't give a fuck about this guy. And I didn't realize it, you know, reading it until maybe a few years in, is because this guy, Spawn and Savage Dragon and all them, they're not intriguing enough where they can live in their own universe. You know, I mean, because they're never going to run into Spider-Man or Batman. You know, they live, it's an outlier. So it's like, you know, this is the ceiling was so low as a reader. You're like, I don't really care.
And you also, one of the things with comics that this is my theory, is that you had a lot of these comic series that were like when I look back at, and in retrospect, the writing was really good and the art was really good. I mean, even the 70s and 80s, is these writers had been around for a long time. And the artists too, but the writing is so important because that's what keeps you engaged. You know, obviously the art is extremely important as well, but you can have an amazingly drawn title, but if the story's not there, it just kind of flatlines, which is what would happen with maybe some of the Spawn issues. But you would have these guys came along, the Todd McFarlane and Liefeld and all them, and they were like kids who drew very well. They were probably very good artists. They probably drew on their notebooks in school, and they were, and you'd see, I mean, I saw a lot of these kids in school that were just had that talent. They would sit there in their notebook and sketch out a character and show me, look who I created. I created this neat character. And they drew them very well. But the problem is they're very good at what they did, but they weren't writers. And the whole thing just falls short once you get got once it comes down to it, they have this visual style which is attractive, but beyond that there's not much there.
Yeah, and then they became popular, they became hot, you know.
And yeah, so, and they didn't have the years under their belt either. I mean, they had a couple of years, but not the years that like a Denny O'Neill or a Roy Thomas had.
Yeah, and then they just basically got too big for their britches. You know, they started mass producing. They started not making deadlines because they weren't businessmen.
Right.
You know, say what you will about like the corporate, you know, money grabbers of DC and Marvel. Those guys are up there. Yeah, they're not artists. They're businessmen. So they're executives. So they know how to keep the ship afloat. All these guys were you know, putting pencil to pad.
Yeah, I think Jim Lee had some business sense, which is why he ended up running DC for a time. But the other ones didn't really have much sense.
So here are some pretty substantial, at least numerically, in the comic world. Amazing Spider-Man 361, it was the first appearance of Carnage, which I wasn't a huge fan, but it's pretty landmark. I actually thought Carnage wasn't going to stick around, but he's still here.
I always thought of Carnage as like a lesser Venom.
Well, they make Venom sympathetic, so he needed a bad guy.
Yeah.
But you had a lot of anniversary issues this year. Captain America 400, which was an 80-page, like, giant behemoth.
Yeah.
Uncanny X-Men 300, Savage Sword,
yes,
of Conan 200 by Roy Thomas and John Buscema.
Great issue.
Amazing Spider-Man 365, which was the special 30th anniversary with a hologram.
Actually, interestingly enough, all those Spider-Man comics that month, that was when they had Spectacular and Web the Spider-Man, all those comics had the foil cover, the fancy foil cup giant size issue. It's just Amazing's was a bigger issue.
Yeah, it was a hologram cover. It came in like plastic.
Mm-hmm.
You also had Incredible Hulk 400, where Hulk fought the leader.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, isn't the Hulk amazing? I mean, one of my favorite titles, but he's a guy that he gets angry, goes nuts, and just like, but every single, like, this was, you know, he's one of the first Marvel characters, and one of obviously, you know, obviously such a favorite. I think
mm-hmm.
because he's, So the character is very simple, and everybody can get it. You know, he doesn't have all these rules of his powers and stuff.
Right.
But those were like pretty landmark. I mean, I think people who read comics who are interested in this portion know that they keep resetting the number. But would you say that this was 92 was maybe the peak in terms of like, or the end of the peak?
Yeah.
The beginning of the
well,
end?
The peak was already, the peak is almost like, I think it's that period in, 1990, I think it was when Todd McFarlane had that Spider-Man number one that was a huge deal. But then September of 91, you had that X-Men number one. And that was like a million, it was a huge amount of copies it sold. And that's sort of the peak. And then 92 was sort of, you're riding the wave from that peak. And it wasn't evident at the time, but the slip was starting. The cracks were showing. They were overstocking these titles. Every title had its monstrous issue. I don't know if you remember, but there was like that Ghost Rider title that was around at the time. Issue 25 had a fold-out. It actually had like this fold-out cover of him riding his motorcycle with his skull, the head on fire, and it's like it popped out. You remember that?
Yeah.
They had all these gimmicks to try to, it was like one gimmick topping the next, and every issue had a special issue with like some gimmick, or they would bag it. They would put it in a bag with a trading card.
Well, yeah, I remember around this time, maybe a little before 92, maybe even 90 or 91, I remember going to the comic book store and just seeing such massive quantities of, you know, what would be like a surefire. Like, for instance, like that Uncanny X-Men 300, there were like piles of that.
Yeah. And it's not worth much now. I mean, that's the thing. Like, I bought that X-Men number one, and I still have all the copies I bought. I think I bought, like, 7 or 8 of them. And they're all pretty much worth about the cover price.
Well, we also had this in 92. There were also a bunch of number ones. You had Punisher War Journal, or War Zone, sorry.
Yes.
I think that's when they gave him a headband. I think we talked about this in the 1987 one. But they gave him a headband, Punisher Warzone. I remember Punisher Warzone, I forget who was the penciler, but that was drawn really well.
That was kind of the tale. That was when, like, there was almost too much of a, in the 80s, it was like there wasn't enough Punisher. People would buy issues of any comic that the Punisher appeared in because they kept them back and he wasn't appearing much. Then he got his own series, and that was fine. But by this time, now you've got 3 series. He had 3 comics. And I even found upstairs in the summer of 92, there was a Punisher Summer Special, this giant size issue.
What's he doing? Is he going to the beach?
No, but he was like, it was like a special, it was like he, all his titles had annuals or whatever, and they had their own special issues, and then this was like a special on top of all the other specials. This was like a self-contained story where he goes on an adventure and shoots up a lot of people. But it was like just overkill, it was too much.
Yeah, this was the era of the mean anti-hero. You had the Punisher, you had Wolverine, you had Ghost Rider.
Yes.
DC tried with Lobo.
Well, I don't know if you remember, but there was also in 92, a title which I kind of liked, actually. They took Captain America's former sidekick and turned him into Nomad, and they made him have long hair, and he was sort of like this renegade. He fit that anti-hero format pretty well.
Oh, yeah. Well, also, remember when they stripped Captain America and they made what's his name?
Yeah, well, that was actually 87 going into 88. That was a long time ago.
Yeah, but what was that guy's, like, they called him something, right?
He became the captain.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then he eventually became U.S. agent.
Did they kill him off?
I don't know. Eventually, he ended up becoming one of the members of last run of West Coast Avengers. Like the later period of West Coast Avengers. So, I think it was when it was called Avengers West Coast.
So your another number one was Spider-Man 2099.
Oh, yes.
I never fucked with
that.
Yeah,
I never got any of those 2099.
Yeah, they looked ridiculous, and I just thought, like, I can't get into, like, stories where, like, well, if this has no impact on what I'm reading, then I don't really give a shit. It's more like a what if.
Yeah, there was a lot of, I think at that point, Marvel had like 50 or 60 titles. I mean, they had a huge number of titles. They were just running too many comic books at that point. Too many series. It was getting too much.
And then you had Spirits of Vengeance, which I think was like a super team with Ghost Rider. And and the Infinity War, which obviously, you know, people who have seen the Avengers movie, it's loosely based on this. I mean, there are some elements of the gemstone kind of story that is in the comics that are missing in the movie. I think it lacks... Well, first of all, the X-Men aren't... the X-Men and Fantastic Four aren't in the movies, which is... That kind of sucks. But you don't have Warlock or the character of Death or Mephisto, and that really sucks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It certainly does. Well, I don't know if you remember, but along the lines of the whole Ghost Rider, you know, that was like we were saying. Well, that's Marvel's trend in that period was just over expanding all their characters to the point where they had so many series. Ghost Rider, they had the Spirits of Vengeance, but then they split into like all these horror titles. There was like Darkhold. There were like three or four, and they were all somehow tied to Ghost Rider, and they were like a It was
just all saturated, and after a while, I think most people were like, "It just everything
well,
just
yeah,
seemed the
it
same."
Well, yeah, it led to the downturn of the industry. I think you started to have the beginnings of the Spider-Man Clone Wars too in that period. I think the elements were starting to begin. I'm not sure. I wasn't regularly reading Spider-Man, but I think characters were starting to appear that would eventually come to fruition in that ultimate Clone Wars storyline, which actually almost killed the Spider-Man franchise in the end.
I don't think there was really a lot going on DC in '92.
At the end of the year there was. The end of the year was the death of Superman.
Oh, right.
Which was huge. I mean, that's where DC just came out of nowhere and took the reins right from Marvel.
That wasn't
a real eventful, probably the first 9 months or so of that year. DC wasn't doing anything really that much out of the ordinary, except lots of appearances of Lobo.
any final thoughts on comics before we switch to music?
No, I think we've pretty much covered the bulk of it.
Yeah, I think '92 was pretty much the tail end of, like, you know, it had comic books had a peak of maybe 90, 91, and then the beginning of the end was 92. And so,
92 was riding that final wave of success. Like, they were still doing really well, but it was showing, and then 93 was, well, DC, interestingly enough, they would follow the event, they would have one event after another then, because you had the death of Superman, and then the next year was when Batman got his spine broken, and Azrael took over as Batman for quite a while.
That was 92?
But that was 93.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
so
that began
that trend, and they sort of took the ball from Marvel on the hype machine for a while.
That Azrael shit went on for like 2 years.
Yeah.
Do they even use Azrael anymore?
how much they use the character. I'm way behind on my current Marvel and DC stuff.
Because he was like Gambit. They just shoved him down your throat. You're like, dude, I'm.
Oh yeah, they made a big deal. Well, they gave him his own title. It was actually a pretty decent book because it was written by Denny O'Neill himself.
So let's shift gears for a little bit. And 1992 was another eclectic year in music. I'm just gonna rattle off some number ones of the year. Color Me Bad, All for Love, George Michael, and Elton John's Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me, Right Said Fred, I'm Too Sexy, Mr. Big, To Be With You, Vanessa Williams, Save the Best for Last, Criss Cross, Jump, Mariah Carey, I'll Be There, So Mix-A-Lot, Baby Got Back, Madonna, This Used to Be My Playground, Boyz II Men, End of the Road, and your favorite, The Heights, How Do You Talk to an Angel, and of course, Whitney Houston's mega hit, I Will Always Love You, which probably was the most dominant song of the year. I'll have to look that up.
Yeah, that was a monster hit. And it was number one for like 12 or 13 weeks, I think.
Yeah, it started in November, and I think it went all the way until, it was remained number one until like the middle of 93.
Wow.
So your general thoughts of the music of 92?
Yeah, I like that year. That was a good year. That was a good year for a lot of pop singles. That was also the year that had a lot of like good, really just really good pop songs that came along were big hits and then sort of disappeared, like John Cicada, Just Another Day. Elton John made a nice had a nice top 10 hit solo with The One. You know, those are all songs that stand out for that year to me. They just like. Even some lesser known songs that were big hits at the time and are kind of forgotten, like remember Joe Public, Live and Learn?
Oh God, I actually didn't remember, but now I do.
That was a top 10 hit. And it's completely forgotten about.
Yeah, that file was deleted until you brought him up just now.
Oh, there's some obscure ones I can remember. The Party, their cover of In My Dreams by Dokken. They were like a dance pop band, so they did a dance pop version of In My Dreams.
You know, speaking of Dokken, there was some pretty, metal was still, kicking ass in 92.
Sort of. That was the year that a lot of the big acts were having their flop albums.
Well, I say that in jest when I say kicking ass. So here's a list of some of the metal. Iron Maiden's Fear of the Dark was 92.
Yeah.
Megadeth, Countdown to Extinction. Damn Yankees, Don't Tread. Warrant's Dog Eat Dog. Ugly Kid Joe, America's Least Wanted. Slaughter the Wildlife. I thought that was earlier than 92.
No, well, if they had one album, they had to Stick It to You, which is 90, and then the Wildlife. That was like their... I thought that was going to be a bigger album, and then it kind of flopped. That's what I mean. Like, you had Ben, you had Warrant, all these bands that had big albums, and they came out with their next album, and they weren't doing so hot.
You had Def Leppard's Adrenalize and Black Sabbath's
Dehumanizer. Yeah, even that was like a downturn from the previous two albums from that.
I have to admit, I didn't even heard of Dehumanizer. What songs are from that?
Oh, did Black Sabbath, The Humanizer? That was the single of a song called TV Crimes, which is actually in Wayne's World, oddly enough. But, that kind of came and went. I liked that album a lot. That was a good one. That was the return of Dio to Black Sabbath.
Well, on a higher note, you also had Pantera's Vulgar Display of Power.
Yes. That was where the pop metal was fading. I should recorrect my earlier statement. Metal wasn't dying, but the pop metal was sort of fading, and it was sort of like you had to be harder, heavier metal to harder edged in order to survive that environment. And Pantera came out of that. Of course, Metallica was still carrying over their huge success from 91. And Megadeth, I mean, Countdown to Extinction brought them to being a big platinum-level band, at least briefly.
You know, it's funny. I thought Body Count was utter shit, and they were just getting notoriety and media exposure because of controversy. But I thought they were terrible.
And I didn't mind that song. I liked the riff on that song, Body Count. Body Count's in the house, or whatever that was. It had like a good riff. But yeah, it wasn't a masterpiece by any means.
You also had Extreme, Three Sides to Every Story.
Yeah, I bought that on cassette when it came out. That was a big deal in Boston.
What were the singles from that?
That had Peacemaker Die was the single, the first single, and then there was a song called. It was Peacemaker Die, and then there was a ballad. I forget the name of it off the top of my head. It didn't do very well. I mean, it was one of those. I think it debuted at like 10, so it was a top 10 debut, but it fell quickly at like gold and was quickly forgotten.
Did they have another album after that?
Yeah, they had Welcome to the Punchline.
Oof. When was that?
Well, then I think they actually got back together years later and made a couple albums, but that was the original run.
You also had Bon Jovi's "Keep the Faith."
Oh yes, "Keep the Faith." Yeah, I mean even that was kind of a downturn. I mean that was like because you'd had "Slippery When Wet" was a huge album. And then New Jersey did very well. It was like 6 or 7 million or whatever it sold. I don't remember anymore, but it was something like somewhere along those lines. And then Keep the Faith was like maybe 2 million. So it was quite a drop. I mean, still very big sales, but quite a drop off. So all these bands that were really big bands were seeing these drop offs.
And don't forget, you know, what, I'm sure you got this. Relatively soon when it debuted, Kiss's Revenge.
Yes. I actually got that the day it went on sale.
And what are some standout songs from that one?
Well, I had Unholy with Gene singing, which was rare to have the Gene singing the lead single. I thought that was going to be a bigger album. I thought that would kind of be a comeback from their last album, Hot in the Shade. I thought that would kind of bring them back to platinum status, but it didn't turn out that way.
You know what's weird is, you know, when you were saying that there was a transition from, you know, the kind of like the pop metal was fading out, but Mr. Big had that hit of you know, To Be With You, that went from February to March. So it was number one for like a month.
Yeah, I mean that was a big hit for them, but they didn't really carry that over. The song was a hit; people liked that song. It caught on; it was a huge hit. But they didn't really connect. I mean, even that album was a "Lean on Me."
Lean into me.
I think something like that. That didn't sell. I mean, it's so. I think it went platinum off that single, but it wasn't a huge album. And then by the time they had their third album, that tanked. So it didn't really. It was a hit because it was a hit, but it didn't really do much for them overall. I mean, it gave them a song to play, and gave people a reason to go see them for years afterwards. But it didn't translate into that sort of. You know, people weren't running out and. Getting their other stuff because of it.
Did they have another single?
There was another single off that album that followed that, and it did pretty well. It was a cover of something, and I can't even remember what it was. maybe a Cat Stevens cover or something. I don't even remember, honestly.
And I don't know if this was in your rotation. Yngwie Malmsteen's Fire and Ice was also released in 93.
Yes, that I did listen to a lot. I thought that was a great album. Yngwie always has been he's had a reputation of being an arrogant prick. A lot of interviewers have said having bad experiences or him having like temper tantrums in concert or whatever. But I always liked his playing, and I always thought he came out with good albums. I've heard most of his albums, at least up to about the mid 90s, and I always enjoyed them. And that was a standout. That was like a good, catchy album in that genre. But he was done too. I mean, that album didn't do that well at all.
So on the other spectrum of music, this is when music was still diverse and eclectic. I'm going to throw out some songs from this year. Shanice's I Love Your Smile, Tevin Campbell, Tell Me What You Want Me to Do, Keith Sweat's Keep It Coming, Jodeci's Stay, Gerald Levert's duet with Eddie Levert, Baby Hold On to Me, Michael Jackson's Remember the Time, which I think was kind of a holdover from 91, right?
Well, no, Remember the Time is really mostly a 90. Early 92 single.
I'm thinking Black
and White was the single.
Yeah.
The first single.
Okay, right. And then Lisa Stansfield, who I completely forgot about, All Woman.
Oh, yes.
Lionel Richie's Do It To Me.
That's right, yeah. The video with all the models.
Yeah, Mary J. Blige just like burst onto the scene with Real Love. So that, obviously, that genre's done too. But what are your thoughts on R&B around this time?
Yeah, that was a good period. That was a solid period for the R&B scene. You'd had I think Luther Vandross is still carrying over from the last year with. The Power of Love album. I think he still had some more singles coming out. You had a bunch of songs from various acts. I think Alexander O'Neill, didn't he have All True Man? Maybe that was 91.
Luther had that duet with Janet, The Best Things
in
Life.
Oh yeah, that gave him a top 10 hit in the summer. Yeah. Yeah. So there was that. I mean, yeah, that was a good, solid period for the R&B scene.
Bobby Brown had Humping Around.
Yes, the follow-up to Don't Be Cruel.
And Troop had a hit with Sweet November, which I thought at the time, now I didn't think Troop was going to be like the Temptations, but I thought, I mean, you have to be of a certain age, of a certain demographic, to know even who could even remember Troop.
Yeah, I barely even remember them.
Yeah, they just, you know, and this, so 92, like this era of R&B, you had groups that are just kind of like one and done, like Troop, Perfect Gentlemen, The Boys.
Yeah. Well, that's what I Joe Public was like the perfect example of that. That Live and Learn was a top 10 hit, but yet I'd be shocked to find somebody who can name whatever the follow up single to that was.
Joe Public and Jodeci was huge in the early 90s.
Yeah, that's what they broke. That was the year that these acts started breaking out, like Jodeci, Mary J. Blige had her breakout. You had TLC. Remember, yep. Ain't Too Proud to Beg sort of launched them as a big deal.
In Vogue, My Love, Never Gonna Get My Love In.
Yes, SWV.
Yeah. Oh, and well, this is more pop music, but Prince had Diamonds and Pearls.
Yes, that's right. Prince had, well, that was really more 91, but yeah, he could. Oh, well, he, that was still when he was releasing an album a year, so he had Diamonds and Pearls, and I think he had another single from that one go into 92. That was The Morning Papers, which gave him a top 40 single. No, I'm sorry. Not The Morning Papers. It was Money Don't Matter Tonight. That's the one, which I think Spike Lee directed the video. And then 92, he had the album that was the symbol. Morning Papers was from that one. Yeah.
So here's some trivia. A white guy from Canada is in the Guinness Book of World Records twice for having the best-selling reggae single in U.S. history, as well as the highest-charting reggae single in history.
Yeah.
That is, of course, as everybody knows, Informer by Snow.
None of those really big hits of that year.
You know why? Because you can't listen to reggae music in the winter. But he made it so that you can.
That's true. Yeah.
I thought it was, I mean, I never mind the song, and I actually kind of like the song, but I thought it was funny how when people, like, found out it was him, like, he's this white guy with glasses, and he's in jail saying, like, when I come out, I'm going to pop you, pop, pop, pop. I'm like, what? You're going to fix my computer.
Yeah, that was pretty funny. I don't even remember. He had another single too.
Yeah.
I can't.
No, the other one, Girl Had Been Hurt.
That's right, Girl Had Been Hurt. No, I Need Another Lover.
Yeah, I think that song's better, but remember the video? Like they're all hanging out outside and the girl has a bikini on in the winter.
That's right, yes, I do remember that, yeah.
So in December of 92, Dr. Dre releases The Chronic and all hell breaks loose.
Yeah, that changed the hip hop. That's for sure.
But such a wide variety of music of, you know, popular number ones. You know, Criss Cross's Jump. Which did they even have a second single?
They did, but I don't even remember it. I do remember them having one, but I can't even name what it was.
Yeah, and then The Heights. How Do You Talk to an Angel?
Yes, that was a big. That's a big hit that's completely forgotten.
Yeah,
I don't think anybody. I don't think I've heard that. I haven't heard that song in years. And the funny thing is, I think the song was still on the charts after the show that it was the main song to had already been canceled.
What do you mean?
The Heights was actually a TV show.
Oh, right. Now,
if I remember correctly, The Heights was the band, and the song was the song that they played in the show. That was like the band's song that they were trying to make it big with, and the song became a hit, but the show tanked, so the song's on the charts and the show's gone.
Now, was that WB?
No, that was Fox. That was a big Fox show. I mean, it was I shouldn't say big Fox show, but that was one of those really well hyped shows for about a week.
So the actor isn't the singer, right?
I don't remember if the people in the song are actually the or performing it in the show are actually the people performing the song for real. That I don't remember.
Yeah, such an eclectic uh, collection of music. And I just love the diversity that we'll probably never get again. R. Kelly's R. Kelly had a few hits: "Slow Dance," "Hey Mr. DJ," and "Honey." I mean that's when he's with still with Public Announcement. So we really didn't get any of his extracurricular activities then.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I don't barely even remember him until, or barely even knew of him until he had the big hit and that what was that song? The one that really put him on the map. From his second out, from his 12th play, or whatever it was called.
You mean him as a solo artist?
Yes, that's. That's where I remember him. I barely even, and I was following R&B, but I barely remember the Public Announcement until after I knew who he was by way of him making it big.
So let's shift a little bit to popular movies of the year. So looking at the box office, okay, so the 92 yearly box office grosses, the biggest movie of the year was Aladdin, and then Home Alone 2, Lost in New York, Batman Returns, Lethal Weapon 3, A Few Good Men, Sister Act, and Bodyguard, and Wayne's World.
Okay.
And then that's 8. 9 is Basic Instinct, 10, A League of Their Own, 11, Unforgiven, 12, The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, 13, Under Siege.
Wow, okay, yeah.
You also had, this year also had a lot of, like, good prestige movies. You know, you had, Last of the Mohicans, The Crying Game, Far and Away.
Yeah, there was a lot of success with the independent movies, I think, around that time.
Right, Reservoir Dogs, so. 92. Well, 92 mm-hmm. was, like, when Miramax really started to gain momentum.
Sure, yeah, definitely.
But... it's weird. Like, I don't, like, a lot of these movies, like, they always, you know, there's some, one thing that I've been noticing that, like, certain eras of movies, they just feel older than what they are. Like, when I see movies from, like, the early 90s, they look like they're mm-hmm. from, like, the 70s or early 80s. It's hard to explain. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's the... It's the film grade, or it's just the way people dress. I don't know. They just have an older feel.
Yes, it could. I actually just watched A Few Good Men again a couple weeks ago. I hadn't seen it since it was in the theaters. And I could see what you're talking about.
Also released this year was The Player with Robert Altman movie. And
yes.
Do you remember how people like jerking off, like, oh my god, this movie's so good.
Yeah, I was at Emerson at the time, and I was in the film program, so I heard everyone talking about it. So I actually went to see it the week it opened, like a couple days after it opened, when it was still brand new. But I haven't seen it since, and I'd be curious to see it again just to see how it holds up.
Yeah, they made a big hoopla about it because it's like all this, like, this insider industry movie, but it's really, that's just the backdrop. It's really a murder mystery. And
yeah.
And so I remember he gets a fax from Vincent D'Onofrio. Tim Robbins gets a fax, and the fax says, in the name of all writers, I'm going to kill you. And I just think it's funny, like, he gets a fax that says, like, I mean, that's something that obviously doesn't stand the test of time, you know, with that, you know, technology.
Right, yeah. I'd be curious to check that one out again. That was like a buzz movie, that was like a big deal when it opened, and then it kind of forgot about it.
And Gladiator, remember that? Not the Russell Crowe
movie. Yes, no, I... The one with Brian Dennehy.
Right, who should have been cast as the Kingpin.
Absolutely. I saw that in the theater when it first opened.
Oh, what was that? The one, was that the theater like Charles Street?
No, I saw it at the one that would always show the Cinema 57, was it?
The Wesley Snipes theater.
Yeah, that was basically that had all those movies, those kind of movies, or it would always end up there. So, because I saw that there, and I also saw there. I think it was the. I saw Under Siege there.
92 also had the introduction of Candyman.
Yeah.
And My Cousin Vinny and the Mighty Ducks, Malcolm X, Single White Female.
Yeah, well, I never saw the Mighty Ducks, but I saw My Cousin Vinny when it came out.
But it's weird how, like, some movies that, like, were such, like, I mean, those are pretty substantial then. Now they, like, they don't get, they're not even on late night or anything like that.
Yeah, and there's not even a venue to see those movies. You own the DVD, a lot of them. Actually, you know what came out? That year had, in the action genre, you had that, the movie that Brandon Lee did. That was his, sort of like his commercial breakthrough.
Oh, The Crow?
No, it was before that. But
Oh, Little Tokyo?
No, it was after.
The movie he did with Dolph Lundgren?
Nope, it was after that one.
Oh.
He had one movie between there that was well-hyped, and I'm blanking out on the name. He had Powers Booth. He and him and Powers Booth together. And the soundtrack was by Hardline with Neil Schon, formerly at that point of Journey.
How can you remember all that but not the name of the title? Rapid Fire.
Yes, that was like his. That was a big, well hyped. It didn't really turn into a huge hit, but it was really well. They really built it up.
I remember when I worked at VideoSmith, a lot of the urban folks all like that move on to check that one out on a consistent basis.
Yeah, I saw it in the theater. I don't think it didn't last long, but it was kind of a big deal, and it sort of set him up for the Crow, for what would be the Crow.
Yeah, Wayne's World was also 92.
Yes.
I think, yeah, I mean, I guess Unforgiven is the one movie that, and Few Good Men, like, those are the ones that really stand the test of time of that year.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Like, Lethal Weapon 3, I remember that was a big deal. My friends and I went to see it at the theater, and, like, the opening night or whatever. And I can't remember anything about it. I can't remember it at all.
Yeah, I don't know who's the villain.
I know nothing about the movie except for there was a big explosion at the beginning.
And I'm assuming Murtaugh wants to retire.
I think that did introduce. No, Joe Pesci was in 2, wasn't he? Also,
he's in 2. But I think he makes the poster in 3.
Yeah, 3 was a big deal in the movie. But I don't remember any details about that one. And we all went to see it, and it was a big deal. Oh, Alien 3 was also around that time.
Lethal Weapon 3 also has the Sting Eric Clapton song, right?
Yes, yeah. That's actually the thing I remember the most from that movie.
Did you see The Bodyguard in the theater?
No.
Yeah,
I've never seen it from beginning to end. I've only seen sections on cable.
Same here. I don't think I've seen. I think that's more than what I've seen. I'm sure it's a good movie. I just have never. Yeah, it just never appealed to me, and I guess maybe one day I will see it.
Yeah, certainly heard the soundtrack enough, but.
You also had Lawnmower Man and Universal Soldier and Sleepwalkers. So this is also kind of like the era of, movies that were just kind of given a different platform. They would just be going straight to USA.
Hell Hellraiser 3, I think, was also one of the movies of that period.
You are correct. Hellraiser 3 was there. Also, and Pet Sematary 2 also. Hellraiser 3, Hell on Earth, but also Pet Sematary 2 was also 92.
Okay, yeah. Because I saw Hellraiser 3 at that Cinema 57.
So let's segue a little bit to the small screen and the top rated television programs of well, you know, because TV, it's kind of weird how it, you know, they start the Nielsen's because the season starts in September, so it's really 91 and 92. The number one show was 60 Minutes. Number two was Roseanne. Number three, Murphy Brown. Tied at four was Home Improvement and Cheers. Six, Designing Women. Seven, Full House. Eight, Murder, She Wrote. Nine, Major Dad. 10, Coach. Wait, Coach is tied with Room for Two. What is that?
Probably one of those shows that benefit. You know, there were those shows that, was that an NBC or ABC?
Both were ABC. Yes, yeah, I think.
Then it was probably one of those shows that would follow Roseanne, would have that 8:30 slot or whatever, and was it by any normal standards a hit? But they just decided to it drew the lead-ins ratings, but sunk enough that it was kind of gotten rid of. Happened a lot. You'd have those top 10 shows that would be following the big hit show, and then as soon as they moved it to a different time slot, it would be gone.
Oh yeah. Quick. Well, NBC was, you know, they had the blueprint on that for Thursday night.
Right. NBC would have the 8:30 shows and the 9:30 shows, and those would always be and they would have big ratings, but they would never be satisfied. They'd say they were dropping 2 minutes. Too much of the ratings from the lead-in show, whether it was Cheers or Friends or whatever, and so they would eventually just banish that show and to its demise. But that show initially got high ratings.
So, Room for Two is an American sitcom. It starred Patricia Heaton and Linda Lavin that aired two seasons on ABC. I still don't know what this is.
You know, I remember seeing spreads for it in the TV guide, but I don't think I've watched even a second of it, ever.
But, yeah, I guess I wasn't watching TV then. This looks awful. This lineup is terrible. You know a show, obviously, that was popular, I've probably never seen a frame, is Evening Shade.
Oh yeah, no, I've never seen it either.
So Evening Shade was 15 overall, and Northern Exposure was 16. That's another show I didn't give a fuck about.
Well, you know, and another show that premiered in that 92 to 93 season that I actually did watch one or two episodes just out of curiosity was, remember Bob Newhart got another show where he was a cartoonist?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It was basically Too Close for Comfort. It was Too Close for Comfort with him as the Ted Nightmare, essentially. Because he was a cartoonist, he had the rebellious adult daughter, whatever, and yeah, I think he had a neighbor live down the hall that was a young guy that would get into arguments with them, but that show didn't stick around too long.
You know, I occasionally watched Major Dad for whatever reason. I've seen a few episodes, but I could say the same thing about Coach. But man, when I found myself watching Coach, I just felt awful. I'm like, oh, what did I do?
I've never seen even a minute of Coach. There are a lot of those shows I just never saw any of that were big hits.
Well, what's interesting is, so down further in the list of 92 is 17 is A Different World and 18 is The Cosby Show. So I guess that's when.
Yeah, that was the end of the line. The Cosby Show. That's right. That was that 91-92 season was the end of the Cosby Show.
That's the final season.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yep.
Yeah, that's when he was like getting hit in the head and stuff, right?
Yeah, well, I never saw any episodes from that season, but by that time, I mean, I assume the cast had to be making big money because as the show goes on, the cast is paid more and more, and the ratings were starting to fall. So even though those are pretty decent ratings, it wasn't profitable, I would imagine. And I would imagine everyone's burned out. What was that now, 8 years into the show? Usually you get pretty burned out.
Speaking, so this list has a lot of shows that I'd never watched, like Empty Nest.
Yeah, that I never saw either. Although I liked the actor there, which is Rick Mulligan. I liked him, but I never saw that show.
Empty Nest and L.A. Law. I've never seen one episode of that.
Yeah, that's another show I never watched.
And Wings. I may have saw one episode of Wings.
That I did watch, because that was on USA, and I would sometimes see it. Yeah, that was around the time I was in college and didn't really watch much regular, normal, primetime TV. And during the summer, I guess I just didn't catch the reruns of a lot of these shows. I was more interested in the syndicate. I always thought that at that point, the syndicated shows were more interesting.
So what's interesting is, as high as 14, it slotted the CBS Sunday Night Movie. So it's like people would watch no matter what bullshit they put on.
That's the whole thing. That it was still the era of the TV movies. Yeah, you just watch the movie. But that format was starting to die because that was a huge format in the 70s and 80s. So that format was starting to die down.
Yeah, man, there's a lot of bullshit. Oh, but another factoid, speaking of TV, 92 was also the year that MTV introduced The Real World, which was for those people that don't know, I don't know what The Real World's still on TV. It's not just about, like fucking in a bathtub. It was actually a reality TV show that was, I think it was, you know, it was good. It was captivating, and it definitely made sense why people watched, and it made sense why other platforms said, wow, we need to jump on this. And of course, it's morphed into all kinds of crazy shit.
That was actually a much more innovative show than what it seemed. I mean, I that's another show I've never seen an episode of, but in terms of retrospect, that spawned that whole reality TV show genre, really.
Oh, and that was also absolutely.
That was also the beginning of the end of MTV having a claim of being MTV. It was starting to begin. There were a couple more years of MTV playing videos, but that was where the programming really started to overtake the videos.
Oh, I forgot. I can't believe I forgot to mention this. But in music, Peter Gabriel released Us. Anyway, also in TV, in May, Jay Leno takes over The Tonight Show.
Yep. That's right. That last week of Johnny Carson was well hyped. That was a big deal.
Who was his last guest? Was it like Bette Midler or something?
Yeah, Bette Midler came. I don't remember all the people in the final. The final episode didn't have a guest, but it was the Thursday night, or the second to the last show, had, I think, Robin Williams, Bette Midler, and somebody else. But Bette Midler sang that song, and that was sort of like the end of the regular show. And then the next show was just him sitting on the stool telling stories. I thought that was well done.
So, Yeah, I mean, what about the late night soap operas? Were they still around in 92?
Oh, what do you mean the prime time, the show, the Dallas and all that?
Yeah, I didn't mean late night. Well, late night for as a kid. Yeah, like Falcon's Crest and Dallas.
Falcon, all of them were done except for Knott's Landing went on. Knott's Landing would have been around in 92.
What is
Dallas
that title?
Ended in 91.
What's that title even mean? I've never understood what does Knott's Landing mean.
It was a street. It was like a cul-de-sac. And the cul-de-sac was Knott's Landing, essentially. I think. I mean, I do remember it was. The show started as basic as the houses that all lived on a certain cul-de-sac, and the people interacting with each other.
You think? Yeah, I guess. Yeah, that's another genre that's gone.
Yeah. Well, then Fox ran with. Then Fox had its own. You had the Melrose Place and all that stuff. They kind of took their own version. But yeah, the glitzy. So, I mean, Knott's Landing wasn't really as glitzy as the other shows were, but you had Dallas and Dynasty and Falcon Crest. Those were sort of the glitzy shows.
So, just some other tidbits before we run out of time here. In the world of video games, Mortal Kombat gets the first ever mature rating. I remember that was innovative. I mean, I've never been a gamer, but I remember that was like, wow, you can beat this guy up and just like rip off his arms and blood comes out.
Yeah. There was a game called Slaughterhouse. I mean, this is getting off the 92 track, but Slaughterhouse was earlier, and that was, I think, for the TurboGrafx-16. That was a pretty gory game, too, if I remember correctly, so.
it's Mark Slaughter begging for another chance.
You could be Mark Slaughter in a video game. another album we forgot. I can't believe, you know, just to turn it back to albums for a second and metal. How can we forget Great White released Psycho Circus?
Oh well, case. Wait. Isn't that a Kiss album?
They had no. Okay, you know you're right. I stand corrected. This is kind of. I had to go through some cobwebs to get this out. Yes, Kiss's album was called Psycho Circus. That was a few years later. Great White's album was Psycho City.
What were the stellar hit singles from that?
I think it was something Motel. The first single was something Motel. I remember that coming out, and it came out not. They only had an album the year before, and they were clearly fading. And I remember that came out, and it really didn't do that well, and disappeared very quickly. That was kind of the end of them as a major act.
So,
but I thought I'd throw that in there.
In toys, the Super Soaker 100 was invented. A little known fact, it was actually invented by a black man. Lonnie Johnson invented the Super Soaker 100.
Okay.
Also, there was the year that troll dolls were really popular. I don't know if you remember that. Like the little troll dolls with the big hair. Like, I don't understand
why. Well, I remember them in the 70s. I don't really remember them in the 90s.
Yeah, they ushered them out in 92 is like, I don't know, people just collected them.
Oh, speaking of video games, though, for a second, and I got off track with my great remembering about Great White. there was a big video game in that year that dominated the end of that year for me was the third Legend of Zelda game.
Wow! Yeah, that's what. Okay, so what was your soundtrack at the time when you were playing that video game in '92?
It would probably have been Metallica, the Countdown to Extinction album by Megadeth, that sort of thing. Would have been one. Of, it would have been in that area of music. Oh, you know, I think I bought. I just probably at the tail end of 92 gotten the cassette for Pantera's Vulgar Display of Power, so it could have been that too.
Beating up elves to Pantera.
And you know, just on a side note, in music, another, and because the Legend of Zelda thing reminded me of this, the tail end of 92, which is when I was playing that game a lot, Green Jelly had Little Pig, Let Me In. Remember that?
Yeah, yeah.
That came out right around that tail end of 92 period.
So you didn't want to invest into any Ugly Kid Joe?
No, I never got into Ugly Kid Joe.
All right, folks. Well, there you have it. That's kind of our summation of the year 1992. It was a interesting time. I thought it was, you know, I think we're all still relatively innocent. I think we were very open-minded and probably the tail end of that kind of open-mindedness. To put it in perspective, 92, you still had voicemails. You still had, most people had an exterior voicemail recording machine. I mean, pagers, people didn't get pagers until 94, I think, or whatever. But 92 was, I think if you look at fashion, I think that's what I was kind of alluding to before. If you look at fashion of 92, it looks like 1981, where people still, the way people dress, their hair. I mean, Tom Cruise gets away with it because that A Few Good Men is like a period piece. And obviously, A Few Good Men is not based in 92. But go look at like Wayne's World and those other movies. That looks really old, really like. Just really dated. Anyway, let us know what you think of 1992 and share your thoughts. Until then, bye for now, and thanks for listening.
Pack it up, pack it in, let me begin. That's a sin. I won't ever slack up. Punk, you better back up. Try and play the role, and you're the whole crew will act up. Get up, stand up. Come on, throw your hands up if you got the feeling. Jump up, touch the ceiling. Monsters are bunk up. Someone's fucking jump, yo, I'll bust them in the eye. And then I'll take the punks out. Feeling funky. Amps in a chunk, and I got more rhymes than this cops at a Dunkin' Donut shop. Sure enough, I got rock from the kids on the hill. With my mom and my pops. I came to get down, I came to get down. So get down to your seat and jump around. Jump around. Jump around, jump around, jump up and get down. Jump, 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 jump. I'll serve your ass like John McEnroe. If your girl steps up, I'm smacking the hoe. Word to your moms, I came to drop bombs. I got more rhymes than the Bible's got songs. And just like the prodigal son, I've returned. Anyone stepping on me, you'll get burned. Cause I got lyrics, but you ain't got none. If you come to battle with a shotgun. But if you do, you're a fool. Cause I do to the death. Trying to step to me, you take your last breath. I got the skill, come get your fill. Cause when I shoot the gift, I shoot the kill. I came to get down, I came to get down. So get out your seat and jump around. Jump around. Jump around. Jump around. Jump up and get down. Jump. To the top. I never eat a pig cause a pig is a cop. Or better yet, a Terminator. Like Arnold Schwarzenegger. Trying to play me out like as if my name was Sega. But I ain't going out like no punk bitch. Get used to one style of when I might switch it up. Up and around, then buck buck get down. Put out your head and then you wake up in the dawn of the dead. I'm coming to get ya, I'm coming to get ya. Spitting out lyrics, homie, I'll wet ya. I came to get down, I came to get down. So get out your seat and jump around. Jump around.